Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later in the program, David Barsamian himself will be with us right here in the Santa Fe Baking Company, and we may also have a little visit from the folks from the Acequia Madre Elementary School. Right now, I'd like to welcome Lynn Klein. She's the author of Literary Pilgrims, the Santa Fe and Taos Writers' Colonies, 1917 to 1950, published by the University of New Mexico Press. Welcome, Lynn.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
Good, good. It's great to have you back. We talked about this book when it was in an early stage. Now it's been published, and you will be speaking and signing books on Saturday at 5 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore.
That's right. It should be fun, so I hope people can come on down and help celebrate the publication of the book.
Now, these writers in the early, sort of the first half of the 20th century, more or less, were these the first English language writers in New Mexico? I mean, New Mexico had been a state for 5 years in 1917.
That's true, and actually they weren't the first English writers here. Excuse me. There were writers who came with the U.S. Army. They were sent out here to do some surveying, and they wrote sort of travelogues, which one of the writers, Alice Corbin Henderson, of this Santa Fe colony that I write about, had access to, and she actually praised it as some of the most interesting writing about American landscape that she had seen in her territory.
A writer's colony, everybody's heard of the New Mexico writer's colony. What actually is a writer's colony? I think a lot of writers today think about their writer's workshops and there's writer's groups. It's not the same thing.
Well, no, a colony is very different from a writer's workshop or a writer's group. And in my book, I talk about a woman named Carol Ann Marling, who was a scholar. And she identified what a colony was. She noted that people came together because one or two landscape artists happened to stumble upon an area of natural beauty, which is what happened here in the case of Taos, which ultimately had an impact on what happened with the writer's colony here in Santa Fe and Taos as well. Or, Marling notes, it could also be a group of creative people who united expressly to establish a counterculture far from the dehumanizing aspects of America's crowded cities. And when you look at what happened here, it was indeed a real colony. These people came together, they wrote works, they collaborated, they actually started their own publishing ventures. They founded a cooperative publishing group called Writers Editions, and they also took on political causes, especially trying to protect and promote the interests of the Native American cultures, which they felt was so important to maintain and preserve for our country's history.
Now, so that was a real sort of political thing they all had in common.
Yes, indeed it was. They all really, in fact, one of the major reasons that they were drawn here was because of the Native American tribes that were here. And people like Mabel Dodge Lujan, who was the Taos founder, essentially, and sort of was the dominating force up in the Taos writer's colony. And down here you had Alice Corbin Henderson, a poet who was an editor, the first editor of Poetry Magazine in Chicago. She was the one who came to Santa Fe in 1917 and sort of founded what was here. And also Widder Binner and Spud Johnson and a whole host of other writers who were here took on, along with the artists, the cause to protect Native American land rights and artistic and cultural practices. And they really believed that these were important to preserve. They felt the indigenous roots of America provided a sort of rhythm, if you will, to America's own literature, separated from what was happening in Europe.
Now, it's interesting because you've got a couple of different dynamics going on. You've got people drawn to New Mexico, but also finding themselves repelled by what's happening in Europe and on the East Coast.
That's exactly why they came here. They were very repelled. And the irony for me when I...
What were they repelled by?
They were repelled by the fact that war had torn apart Europe's major cities and that there were bloodbaths, you know, the amount of loss of life. Much like what was going on today in Iraq, was just overwhelming to them. And they thought that America had lost its soul, and it had become industrialized and mechanized, and technology was taking over. And they just felt that it had also become overly commercialized, and the culture had become rather crass. And as soon as they got to New Mexico and saw sort of the untouched landscape and the untouched traditions of timeless, you know, the Spanish colonial people, the Native American people, they really believed that this was a place where they could create and they could get in touch with something that had been lost in America's major cities and in Europe, too.
It's sort of weirdly ironic because the railroads really marketed Santa Fe as a tricultural paradise, which was a fabrication. It was a myth, you know. I mean, based on shreds of reality, but it was a marketing myth created to draw people with money to take the train out to the tricultural paradise and go home with a pair of moccasins.
Indeed it was. That's exactly right. And that, to me, was the great irony. These people came here to escape all of that. And what they did by being here and writing about it and also painting about it, because the artists and the writers' colonies were inextricably linked, they promoted Santa Fe as a great tourist destination. And in the end, many of them realized that what they had done was sort of to bring about the ruin of a place that had, prior to their arrival, been relatively untouched.
Well, that's the thing, that they had an effect on this place. It wasn't just that they were affected by it.
Exactly. And, you know, Mabel Dodge Lujan, in some of her writings, later lamented Taos and, Taos's demise as a tourist town, and she called it Tinseltown. And Frank Waters also. Frank Waters was a wonderful Taos writer, and he was a mystic. And he had been raised in Colorado Springs, and he had done lots of different things, traveling around the country and working for the telephone company in Los Angeles and as an engineer. And he eventually ended up in Taos, where he really got in touch with his mysticism. And at the end of the book, I have a little comment from him that I found in... it was in a magazine in which he too laments what happens in, this is how he described northern New Mexico in 1951. World War II abruptly ended the period with the great influx of new residents. The beauty of the valley, the slow tempo of the Spanish-American villages, and the rhythmic appeal of Pueblo life have given way to the ruthless demands of economic development and commercial exploitation. Art is no longer paramount. The supermarket, the filling station, the travel folder, and highway billboards advertise Taos as no different than any other spot in America. And I suppose we could say that's a fight that we're still continuing today.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who say, oh, it was so great in 1970.
Right. And when we think about it, 1951 really wasn't that long ago. And I think, you know, when I got here in 93, I think that I was really struck by being able to walk around Santa Fe and Taos and see the remnants of these writer colonies. Many of the houses are still here. You can walk into La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe or in Taos and still get a sense for what it must have been like, you know, in the heyday of these colonies to come together. They would meet and have cocktail hours. They would have balls, you know, where they'd all dress up in, you know, wild costumes, jungle costumes and things. I found wonderful descriptions in La Fonda Hotel file, which really brought to life this whole era. And these guys were prolific at writing, but they were also incredible partiers.
So they party animals.
They were. They were definitely party animals. And I think that did get in the way of what they actually were able to produce. And I have a feeling that may be the reason why D.H. Lawrence and Willa Cather couldn't really tolerate it here too long, especially Willa Cather. She was such a serious writer.
I was going to say, those are the most, in a way, the most serious authors whose work has stood the test of time.
Exactly. And it's interesting to note that they just weren't here that long. D.H. Lawrence did visit for three different occasions and stayed for, you know, months at a time, but eventually he had to leave, and he and Mabel kept clashing, and Mabel had lots of parties, and I think he just felt that he really needed to get away and write, and that's why he eventually moved out to the ranch up in San Cristobal, north of Taos. But even that wasn't far enough away from Mabel. So he, you know, eventually would leave and then write about New Mexico. I think that New Mexico is definitely his favorite spot of all the places he visited in the world. This was the one he would come back to and be able to take solace in and find enough solitude that he could write. Or if he couldn't write while he was here, he would write about it after he'd left.
We're talking to Lynn Klein, and the book is called Literary Pilgrims, the Santa Fe and Taos Writers' Colonies, 1917 to 1950. There's some great stuff in here which is so parallel to things that are happening today. I had the poet and writer John Davis on not long ago talking about writing poetry in other personas. That's what Witter Binner did.
That's right, he did indeed. And his greatest persona actually was as a Chinese sort of haiku writer, he traveled to China several times, and his biographer James Craft noted that after he returned from China and began working on translating Chinese poems, he really found his own voice and his own rhythm. Prior to that, I think he was highly influenced by what was happening in American poetry at the time, in European poetry, And you can really sense a change in his work once he found this way of writing about the seasons and connection with human emotion and really digging deeper like that. So he was really an interesting character. He was really set on a course for great fame, I think. He went to Harvard. He was working at Maclean's magazine, which was a famous magazine at the time, where Willa Cather, Upton Sinclair, lots of people were writing and exposing. You know, they were doing muckraking at that magazine. And then he left there because he felt that he wasn't able to focus on his own work. And when he made his way out here, as so many of the other writers who eventually landed here and stayed here, he really left behind the mainstream East Coast literary establishment. And I think that sort of hurt his reputation. He sort of just disappeared.
But then this hoax, what was it called?
Oh, the Spectra hoax. Yes, that was amazing. He and his, excuse me, one of his colleagues from Harvard got together and created a whole school of poetry that was sort of parodying what was happening at the time in American poetry. And they were...
But they made up authors and gave them names.
That's
right. And it was really just them.
It was just them, and nobody knew. And everybody was talking about these wonderful writers. And there's a great story about Witterbinder being at dinner with a famous editor and the editor asking if he'd met these two poets yet. And Binder says, well, actually I have, and they're wonderful people. And he just would not let on that it was him. And I think after it was exposed, it was several years afterwards that it was exposed, a lot of poets were really hurt and angry that he was so, you know, making fun of their style. So I think that was another thing that hurt his career as well.
It's funny when you write about artists and poets and writers and so on, there's always that borderline where it gets into just gossip. There's the famous incident of Witterbinder pouring a glass of beer over the head of Robert Frost.
Yes.
And you include it because you have to. But can you believe he put that glass of beer over it?
Exactly. Well, that was one of the things that I could include because there was documentation of it in various publications and literary journals and things of the time. There were others that I couldn't clarify, and so I had to leave them out because I just didn't want to be perpetuating a legend. And some of them were pretty intense and serious and unbelievable. Actually, so I wanted to work.
So probably rumors.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was a real kind of divide between Santa Fe. You talk about the Santa Fe and Taos writers colonies, and we think of these two places as not that far away from each other. I mean, it's an hour and a half drive, but back then it was a real gap between them, and you belonged to either one or the other.
That's right. Although they often got together for. You know, there was something called the Burson Bill, which was an attempt to take away Native American lands and give them to Anglo and Spanish colonial settlers. And basically, these writers felt that that was an insult and just really encroaching on their rights. So they got together, and it was the writers in Taos, the writers in Santa Fe, and they contacted people all around the country and enlisted the help of people like Carl Sandburg and Maxwell Parrish, the painter, and various other people signed on to a petition, and they actually got the bill defeated, which was a wonderful thing. So they did come together over causes, over the love, shared love of the region and the region's cultures, and they would travel back and forth and stay at each other's houses. But of course, there were rivalries and jealousies that ended up interfering with things. Mabel Dodge Lujan and Witterbinder didn't speak for something like 50 years after Mabel wooed away Witter's secretary, Spud Johnson, who was the founder and editor of Laughing Horse magazine and a great poet himself who wrote for The New Yorker. And Mabel took Spud away with her up to Taos to become her secretary, that was sort of the straw that broke their friendship, and for 50 years they did not speak. So there were things like that. And Mary Austin also was a very strong personality. She was one of America's first women naturalist writers, had a wonderful connection with nature and wrote a lot about it. She also was a playwright and a poet and a lecturer and very famous in her time. She came to Santa Fe and I think settled here rather than Taos because she and Mabel would have definitely butted heads over who was the stronger one there. And I think Mabel settled in Taos because Alice Corbin Henderson was already here in Santa Fe and she was already an established poet. So, you know, it's just very interesting to see all the intricate behind the scenes.
It's like National Geographic, you know. Territorial behavior.
Exactly. Staking out where you can be most comfortable and be most dominant.
Now, Mabel Dodge Lujan is a character about whom we could talk for hours on end. I've always found her sort of annoying, even though she's an amazing character. But it seems that her personality and her activities far outdid her actual work.
I think that's very true. Although if you do look at her memoirs, she wrote four very, you know, tome-like memoirs. And the last was...
Did you slog through them?
I tried. I really did. The ones I focused on were the ones that focused on her time in Taos. I read a little bit of the early ones. They're really interesting, but they're very narcissistic, completely self-centered. And it was hard to read a lot about her. The one book that she wrote that was very interesting, actually, was called Lorenzo in Taos. And it was the story about her relationship with D.H. Lawrence, whom she called Lorenzo. And that was very revelatory. She talked about, you know, using sort of witchcraft and voodoo to conjure a spell to lure him to New Mexico, and then she believed that he alone had the potential to write about the Native Americans and reveal them to the world. And she also wanted him to cast her as the heroine in a novel, and they fought bitterly over that, and Lawrence refused to do it, and at one point he stomped away and said he would never talk to her again, but of course he did come back. I had a hard time with her as well, and she's got two chapters in the book, the only one who has two chapters, because there was really, up in Taos, most of it centered around her, and I broke them up into her life before Lawrence came and then after Lawrence left. And she was complicated. What's interesting about her is that she was so willing to talk about her own turmoil. She was just constantly searching for a way to express herself. And she
at our expense.
Yeah, at our expense, exactly. And she was treated for years by A.J. Brill, who was a psychotherapist in America who was influenced by Freud. So she was really, you know, undergoing analysis. And I think, you know, if we were to look at her today, we might say she had something like manic depression, because she just cycled up and down. And Lois Rudnick wrote a wonderful biography about her, which goes into all of that. She was probably the hardest person to write about. And there were times when, in the middle of those chapters, when I just wanted to put the book down, walk away, and have nothing more to do with it.
We're talking to Lynn Klein. The book is called Literary Pilgrims. So how did you get into this whole writer's colony? Was there one writer who really caught your attention and awakened your passion for the New Mexico literary
scene? I think it was Willa Cather. When I first moved here in 93, I came out to do a graduate program, and we focused on language and literature and writings about New Mexico. And in this one class I took called Reinventing New Mexico, we were looking at how tourism created, you know, a whole myth of Santa Fe, as you were alluding to earlier. And when I found out in that class that Willa Cather had been here and had written one of her most famous books based on what had happened in Santa Fe, the life of Archbishop Lamy, I was really surprised. I had no idea. I'd never even heard of a writer's colony in New Mexico. And I had been an English major, so I figured I would have heard about that somehow. And so when I read Death Comes for the Archbishop, which is just an amazing book, I really began to take an interest in what brought her here and what she, you know, why she was here, how long was she here, who else was here. And then I began to discover this whole, you know, group of other writers I'd never even heard of. Mary Austin, Widder Binner. So I would say it was probably Willa Cather, and also finding out that D.H. Lawrence had been in Taos, too. That was something I never knew either.
Now, you were talking about how you didn't read these, you'd never heard of Willa Cather, even though you'd been an English major.
Oh, no, I'd heard of Willa Cather, but just not her being in New Mexico.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
But some of these writers you hadn't heard of, I certainly hadn't heard of even Willa Cather till I moved to New Mexico, not having been an English major. But are these writers being taught in New Mexico schools, in the university? Do you know?
That's a great question. I don't know. I'm sure that I know that Willa Cather's Death Comes for the Archbishop has been the best-selling book of New Mexico since it was published in 1926, I believe, or 27.
Amazing.
So I would assume that some people are reading that in their English classes. I also know that Frank Waters he's got a cult following, and there are people all around the region, because he also wrote about Colorado, his native state, who have come together and study him, you know, as a group. And there's somebody up in Colorado, John Nizalowski, I believe is his name, who's writing a biography of him. And there's actually a foundation in Taos that is tended by Frank Waters' widow, Barbara. And that has been going for several years, and they give scholarships to people. They bring in artists in residence who have an interest in Waters' interests, art, photography, and music. And then they give them residencies, and they live on the land where Frank Waters lived in up in Taos. So I would assume that some of these people are being taught, hopefully Fray Angelico Chavez, who was the first sort of Chicano writer. Hopefully he's being taught too, you know, because his work, he's got short stories and poetry, which are wonderful to read. And I have a little section on him in the book, but it's not long enough, of course.
Yeah, and I mean, each chapter in this book could be a much longer piece in itself, so this is a real kind of introduction and the basics to New Mexico writers, and it's a wonderful, very readable book.
Great, I'm glad you like it. Well, I wanted to give people an overview, and just to, you know, so they could see what is out there, how much literature there really is. Some of it's still in print, some of it's out of print, but you can find it in libraries, in bookstores, you know, in used bookstores, you can track down some of the out of print books. And really, I just wanted to remind people that this work is here and it's worth reading because it's still very relevant today. And I think that a lot of what they did has been completely overshadowed by the art colony.
That's right. We've only got about a minute left. Would you like to read a little section from the book, a little preview to your Saturday afternoon reading?
Absolutely. I'll read you a little bit from the introduction, which just to sort of give a sense of how the book goes and what the book contains in it. This is from the opening of the introduction. Santa Fe has long been a major tourist mecca shaped by the allure of the exotic. Its intriguing myth of ancient culture, rugged beauty, and alternative lifestyle has, across the centuries, captured the imagination of the explorer, the adventurer, the seeker, the outcast, and the artist. The same is true of Taos, though on a smaller scale. Starting at the close of the 19th century, however, the appeal of these two towns grew particularly potent, drawing countless sojourners and settlers who possessed highly creative artistic aspirations. Artists and writers of every ilk started trekking to northern New Mexico in the early 20th century, fleeing a modern world obsessed with war. Weary of a culture marred by excessive materialism, greed, corruption, and mechanization, these Southwest newcomers found hope for a better future they encountered, as well as with the Hispano people who had put down roots in New Mexico generations earlier. They firmly believed that living in this remote part of the country offered an antidote to America's focus on urbanization, industrialization, and preoccupation with military power starting in the World War I era. Accessing the remote high desert of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains a century ago required infinitely more time, courage, and physical strength than it does today. Voyagers made the arduous journey by carriage, horse, or primitive railroad cars, which first serviced Santa Fe in 1880. Northern New Mexico's dry desert air, forested mountains, and flat-top mesas have wielded a rough sort of magic on its denizens, from the ancient ancestors of the Pueblo people to 16th-century Spanish explorers, 19th-century traders of the Santa Fe Trail, and the lively group of prolific writers who established literary colonies in Santa Fe and Taos from the early 1900s to the outbreak of World War II. As Pulitzer Prize winning author Paul Horgan once wrote, experiencing the Southwest could be devoutly spiritual, especially in Santa Fe, situated at 7,000 feet and surrounded by the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. As he wrote, vision receives it all with a sense of new power. The earth seems near to the heavens, and in the light of sun, moon, or stars, even its distant features can be discerned strangely well, by night in all their flowing contours, by day in all their color.
Lynn Klein, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been a pleasure. It's great to see you, as always.
As always. Lynn Klein is the author of Literary Pilgrims, The Santa Fe and Taos Writers' Colonies, 1917 to 1950, published by the University of New Mexico Press. And once again, she'll be speaking and signing books on Saturday at 5 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore, which is right across the street from the Lensic Theater over on West San Francisco. We will see you soon. See you then.
Great. Thanks. I hope to see people at the reading.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Bill Beecham. He's the principal of the Acequia Madre Elementary School. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
What's happening over at the school? Is this one of those small schools that everybody is talking about in the news?
Oh, they were. It seems to have kind of died down a little bit now. But as far as all of that goes, it raises its head about every year or two because we are small. And, you know, that discussion of whether we need to close schools to make the district budget work has happened before, and it usually passes, and we're still there, and I think we will always be there.
So what's happening over at the school now?
We're getting geared up for our big annual art auction, what we call our art auction, this Saturday, March 10th, at the Eldorado Hotel at 5 o'clock in the evening. And it's open to everybody that wants to come. And it's one way, because of the nature of the programming we have at Acequia Madre, that our parents really gear up and do a fundraiser. It probably brings in half of what we raise every year to do the specialized programming that we provide for kids at Acequia Madre.
And so, unfortunately, public schools aren't sufficiently funded, and they have to do their own fundraising.
Well, you know, that's always been partly true, because they pay for the basic stuff, and if you want to take really nice field trips or provide really enriching art experiences or something, you typically do need extra money. Acequia is unique in that we don't generate any of what I call soft money, because we don't have a Title I program or a bilingual program that generates federal funding. So some of the bigger schools do get that funding, and they can use it a little more liberally than they can the operational dollars. So what my parents do is they work hard and raise money so that we can provide the programming that we do that goes beyond what the district pays for.
So, once again, tell us the whens and wheres of the annual art auction. This has been going on for 13 years.
I've been there 5 years, and it was going on before I got there, and it's just one of the most incredible events. The first year, I had no idea what to expect.
Do you really get the general public, or is it mostly parents and
there's a lot of parents, but we get a lot of general public. You know, there's a lot of folks in town. We're not the only ones that have these kind of auctions. There's different ones during the year, but I think a lot of Santa Fe people know about them. They know that people from a variety of budget levels can come and enjoy and get some really good deals. I would like to point out, it's not just an art auction, although we call it that. We have a silent auction with lots of different things, everything from manicures or pedicures and massages and lessons for your kids to take and nice dinners at restaurants and a lot of smaller items that you can get really good deals on. And then we have some really large, nice items that people like to know about in our live auction. Like, for instance, this year we have a original oil by Elias Rivera. We have a North Maui estate for 1 week. It's probably worth about $5,000 or so. We have a VIP weekend at Palms Casino.
Only
Resort.
1 week, huh? You don't get the estate?
No. But, you know, so there's some high-dollar things that people can still get good deals on, but there's a lot of really reasonable items and stuff for just about anybody that wants to come and party with the Acequia Madre parents and have a good time and go away with some good deals.
Well, Bill Beecham, thank you so much for being with us. The Acequia Madre Elementary School Art Auction is on Saturday, this coming Saturday, March 10th at 5:30 in the afternoon at the Eldorado Hotel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take another little break right now. David Barsamian is standing by. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome David Barsamian. He's producer and host of Alternative Radio, which airs right here on KSFR on Tuesdays at 6:30. And he's the co-author of the forthcoming book, Targeting Iran, with Noam Chomsky, Ervand Abrahamian, and Nahid Mozafari. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be in Santa Fe with my voice.
A little frog in his throat, but here nevertheless. And, of course, you will be speaking tonight at the CCA in an event co-sponsored by KSFR. In order to understand Iran, which is very important right now for the general public to understand Iran, you've got to go at least 50-plus years back in history. You point out in the introduction to your new book that there's a very important event that happened in 1953 that even people who write tomes about Middle Eastern history leave out.
That's rather striking. You're referring to the CIA coup, overthrowing a democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh, a very popular leader who had the notion that Iranian oil should go for the benefit of the Iranian people. And so the CIA, prodded by the British, decided to overthrow Mossadegh. This was a crushing blow for democracy in the Middle East and in Iran specifically. Iran had a history of democratic initiatives. As early as 1906, There was a Majlis, which is the parliament. There were democratic elections. And so this was a huge setback for democracy in the Middle East. The Shah returned to power. He had gone into exile. And one could say with confidence that the overthrow of Mossadegh directly led to the Islamic revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979.
Now, how did that happen? Tell us that dynamic.
Well, when the Shah returned to power, sitting on the peacock throne, he ran a very repressive regime. And the only place where there was any kind of discourse was in the mosques. So democratic conversations were not happening in NGOs and things like that. They were happening, regime change and discussions about the Shah were happening in the mosques. And that, of course, led directly to Khomeini's returning in 1979 and establishing the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Now, when we talk about the 1953 coup, basically, you quote American political leaders of the time of saying, that's not their oil, that's our oil.
In fact, George Kennan, one of the senior State Department planners, a very honored and revered figure in American diplomacy, he said it's our oil and we have to protect it. That's been the attitude, kind of sub rosa, for many, many years. Iranian government made oil available to the British and American oil companies at a very low price. The Shah spent billions and billions of dollars on weapons. So Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin were delighted with that kind of situation. But what was happening internally in Iran was completely missed. Now, you know, there was a lot of talk about misintelligence and bad intelligence on Iraq. There's a history to this in the Middle East. You have Jimmy Carter going to Tehran and toasting the Shah on New Year's Eve 1977 and calling Iran an island of stability, and that the Shah was loved and admired by the Iranian people. I mean, this would have come as a news bulletin to a lot of Iranians who were very unhappy with the Shah's regime. 6 months before the actual revolt, the CIA issued a report saying that Iran was not in a revolutionary or even a pre-revolutionary stage. So they really don't know what's going on the ground. They don't have culture, sensitivity. They believe their own press releases.
I mean, is it that they just see what they want to see?
It's hard to say. I just went to Iran last month. This was the second trip. The last time I went was during the Shah's rule. And it was apparent to me then that this can't last. I mean, it was very autocratic, a monarchy, very repressive. But it was obvious to me, but clearly not obvious to the doyens in the State Department.
Going back again to 1953, how was the coup in Iran presented to the American public? I mean, it wasn't in the newspapers, we want their oil, therefore we're sending Kermit Roosevelt in to incite revolution and pay people off. How was it? How did it play to the public?
Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, cousin of Franklin D. Roosevelt, so part of that lineage. The British had been encouraging the Americans to overthrow Mossadegh. Britain is now in economic and political decline. They don't have the muscle that they had before World War II. So they really needed the Americans to effect this operation. And they were getting nowhere with Truman.
Now, what was in it for Britain?
Well, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was controlled. This is the predecessor to British Petroleum. So a huge economic interest. And Truman rejected the British overtures to overthrow Mossadegh. However, Eisenhower comes into office in 53. John Foster Dulles takes over as Secretary of State, his brother Alan Dulles, head of the CIA. And they are very susceptible to notions of anti-communism. So the British convinced the Dulles brothers and Eisenhower that Mossadegh was, you know, going to go toward the Soviet Union. And that's all it took. Once you, you know, wave the red flag, you know, people go into kind of, you know, almost an automatic response. Yeah, they go into a tizzy. Oh, the communists can't have that. He was not a communist. He was actually educated at the Sorbonne. He was a nationalist leader. He believed that the oil, Iranian oil, should go for the benefit of the Iranian people. 100% of the profits were being repatriated outside the country.
So when you we had the event in, well, the Iranian Revolution in 79, how did that play in the American press?
Well, that was a huge blow to American hegemony in the Middle East. The Shah was, he was their boy. He provided cheap oil. He spent billions of dollars on weapons. And Iran was considered part of the network of countries in the region, non-Arab, incidentally, Israel, Turkey, Pakistan, and Iran, to control the oil, basically, for the United States. So it was a tremendous blow. I don't think the U.S. has ever actually recovered. And a lot of what you see today is about payback. It's payback for the hostage crisis. It's payback for overthrowing the Shah.
Well, let's jump to the present. You were recently in Iran, and we want to hear about your trip. But I think it's also important to talk about what is Iran. In other words, it's a Farsi-speaking country. It's a Persian country. What does that mean?
Well, it's 50% of the population is Persian. There are large ethnic minorities. It's a multilingual, multi-ethnic country. So there are Azeri Turks, there are Kurds who speak a dialect of Farsi, there are Baluchis in the south east, there are Arabs along the Persian Gulf. And so while Farsi is the national language, there are all these other languages as well. 90% of the population is Shia. This is a very important point, because Iraq and Iran are the only two major states where there is large numbers, majority numbers of Shia. And so Iran is very concerned about what's going on in Iraq. Saddam Hussein, who was a Sunni, repressed the Shia for many, many years. And so there's close contact. All of the major religious sites for the Shias are in Iraq, Karbala and Najaf specifically. There's the shrine of Imam Ali in Najaf and the shrine of Imam Hussein in Karbala. You can't understand Iranian culture without having an appreciation for the role of Shia Islam. Shia Islam began, you know, as a divergence. It had to do with the succession to the Prophet. And the Shias, which means the party of Ali, they said that it should be, the lineage should be by blood. So that would mean Ali and Hussein and the imams that would follow. However, the Sunnis, which is the other large Islamic formation, which is about maybe 70-75% of the world's 1.2, 1.3 billion Muslims, they said it should be a consensus of the ummah, of the community. It should not be based on the Ahl-e Bayt, the bloodline of the Prophet. So there was a split right at the very beginning of Islam. Unlike the split between the Protestant Church and Catholicism, it came centuries after Christianity developed. This was right at the top when Islam forms in the 7th century. The Prophet dies in 632 A.D., and that's when there is this split.
Now, are those differences really guiding the split between the two groups at this point, or is it more, I mean, have they divided into sort of different cultures, different ways of thinking?
Well, in Iraq, I mean, we're not talking about Iran, I mean, there's
Iraq.
Rivers of blood. There's sectarian violence on a scale never seen in the Middle East.
But I mean, it's hard to imagine it. We believe that the successor to the prophet should be by blood, and therefore I'm going to kill you, because you believe that it should be by community consensus.
Well, the Al-Qaeda is very much informed by a particular strain of Islam. It's called Wahhabism. It's named after Muhammad Wahhab, who was an 18th century religious leader in Saudi Arabia. It is extremely intolerant. It views, and this is the Taliban. This is the this is how it's connected to Afghanistan. The Wahhabism sees the Shias as heretics. They're not even Muslims, and so they should be extirpated. They should be eliminated. This is a very extreme fundamentalist form of Islam, and so many of the Al-Qaeda related groups in Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan view the Shias as heretics and not Muslims. So there are attacks on Shias, their processions are attacked, their mosques are bombed. This is a regular occurrence.
Now, getting back to Iran, so you have a large Shia population. What does this mean in terms of the other neighbors besides Iraq in the region?
Well, neighboring Afghanistan, where there's a large NATO and U.S. military force, there is a very large Shia population. Iran has very close ties culturally, historically, politically with Afghanistan. Half the population speaks Farsi, a form of Farsi. It's called Dari. And so there's a very close cultural, historical, political link between those two countries and Iraq as well, although Iraq is Arab. It's important to point out that Iran is not an Arab country. The Iranians are Indo-European. They speak an Indo-European language, and there's although they share the same religion, Islam, they don't share the Sunni version of Islam.
We're talking to David Barsamyan, and he's going to be speaking at greater length than we can get into now about these issues tonight at the Center for Contemporary Arts on Old Santa Fe Trail at 7:30 in an event co-sponsored by KSFR and hosted by yours truly. Let's turn to Iran in the present. I mean, it's clear that there are drumbeats of war, that they're searching for pretexts to attack Iran. What is really going on there? I mean, is it about the nuclear issue?
Well, according to the Director of National Intelligence, Michael McConnell, last Tuesday before the Armed Services Committee, he said Iran, this is their estimate, is anywhere from 5 to 10 years away from actually developing a bomb. So this flies right into the face of the kind of Fox hysteria of, you know, they're about to get a bomb, we're going to get wiped out. There's no evidence for that. So I think people should be very leery, particularly on the heels of the Iraq episode, to be whipped into a propaganda frenzy that, you know, they're about to invade Santa Fe, they're about to take over New Mexico. Iran is surrounded by U.S. military forces. I mean, it's not a joke. I mean, in Afghanistan, the Persian Gulf is a virtual U.S. lake. In Iraq, in Turkey, they're completely surrounded. And so the notion that Iran is a military threat to the United States is very far-fetched.
So what is it? We want their oil the way we wanted in 1953? I mean, what do you think is really going on?
Oil is certainly a major factor. The U.S. does not want any state to be independent, to operate outside of U.S. hegemony. That's considered a threat.
That region, anyway.
Yes. I would give it, I use this analogy. It's kind of like the Godfather. You know, he can have local capos, local, guys who are designated to control certain neighborhoods. But if one of those capos suddenly breaks out and say, hey, I'm going to form my own family, and I'm going to, carry on, in a very different way. That threatens the Don's credibility. all of a sudden, because this is contagious. What if other people start thinking, well, you know, maybe I'll start my own family? And so that has always been one of the cornerstones of U.S. foreign policy. Why are they so hostile to Chavez? Why are they so hostile to Morales in Bolivia? Because they represent a departure from the former, you know, supine and obsequious relationship between Venezuela and Bolivia and Washington.
Getting back to the nuclear issue, there does seem to be a nuclear program, a uranium enriching program. I think maybe a lot of people don't understand that in order to enrich uranium to make a power plant, you need to enrich it a little bit. In order to enrich uranium to make a bomb, you need to enrich it to over 90% of a particular isotope. It's a very, very big difference. Do we know what they're doing there, what the intention is? I mean, if it's nuclear power, why does a country with more oil than you can possibly imagine want a nuclear power program?
This is a point that's often made by Washington. They have oil, therefore this program has to have a military component. But in fact, the Iranians are saying that oil is a finite resource and we want to preserve it so that we do need atomic energy for so-called peaceful purposes. Under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran is a signatory as well as the United States, any country has the right under Article 4 to develop atomic power for peaceful purposes. Now, the U.S. is saying that it's not for peaceful purposes.
Well, how do we know the truth?
Well, Al-Baradei, the Nobel Prize winner, who is the head of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency based in Vienna, he says there is no concrete evidence. I mean, they want to have spot checks, and Iran says they will cooperate with Al-Baradei and the IAEA, but they won't do it with a gun pointed at their temple, which is what the Bush administration is insisting on, that Iran has to capitulate. It has to make certain concessions before they sit down. So, in other words, the negotiation is to produce a priori the results that a negotiation would produce if you had negotiations. And that's not sitting well with the Iranians. They're a proud people. I mean, all people are proud.
Everybody's proud.
Everyone's proud, and they don't like being pushed around.
And that's something that anybody can understand. And you make the point that democracy is something that happens peacefully and organically in a country where people are not under threat.
This is what Nobel Prize winner Shirin Ebadi told me. She's a distinguished lawyer and a judge. I talk about this in the book. She was in Denver about a year ago, and I spent some time with her. She said, democracy cannot be imposed out of a barrel of a gun. Let us do it, she says. You know, let Iranians figure out how to, affect social change in Iran. If it comes out of Washington, it'll never be accepted.
Well, David Barsamian, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And there's so much that we didn't get to. So, ladies and gentlemen, you'll have to come to the talk tonight at 7:30 at the Center for Contemporary Arts, which is on Old Santa Fe Trail. I'm very much looking forward to hearing about your trip there, who you talked to, what you did, what it was like. Very few people can even get a visa into Iran. So we'll find out how you did all of that. Thanks for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Shaw.
David Barsamian is producer and host of Alternative Radio, which airs on Tuesdays at 6:30 here on KSFR. And he's the co-author of many books, including the forthcoming book, Targeting Iran, with Noam Chomsky, Ervand Abrahamian, and Nazid Mozafari. Once again, tonight at the CCA, we will see you there. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Richard Block is sitting in for John Greenspan with Good Morning Jazz. He's going to be playing music by featured pianist Don Shirley and also Santa Fe's own cabaret singer Catherine Donovan and jazz vibraphonist Dick Sisto. All this and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station. My name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.